the question of what's the nature of investigation and how to best apply that, to do that. This came up a few times in the interviews, and I guess during your question time this afternoon, that cropped up. So I thought I might begin there this evening. Now, oftentimes, the quality of thinking, just the process of thinking, is treated like a kind of disease, sort of brain disease, in the meditation world. Like, this is this kind of infection that we suffer from, and if we could just get rid of it, then everything would be fine. And even though we might not articulate it that way, or maybe we do. Even if we don't articulate it in that way, that can easily be an undercurrent of attitude. That if I'm thinking, if there's thinking going on, then this is not legal meditation. Then I'm having a bad meditation if there's a thought, and then if there's no thinking, then this is good. And so it's helpful to kind of change the view on that. Because from the Buddhist perspective, just as sound is the object perceived by the ears, and light is the object perceived by the eyes, taste is the object perceived by the tongue, so thought is the object perceived by the brain. That the brain is just another sense organ, and what it's designed to perceive is thinking, mental activity. It's also unusual insofar as it's also the coordinator of the other five senses, but essentially it's most accurate to think of, to regard thought as another sense object. So just as we can be completely lost in something that we hear or feel or see or taste or touch, or we can be mindful of it, we can be aware of it. So too, exactly the same way with thinking, that just as there can be the mind absorbed into thought and carried away by it, so too that there can be the mind clearly aware of thought and unconfused by it. The thought actually just decorates the silence of the mind, so that the quality of it's true that we are a very thinking culture. We're trained to think, and our brains are stimulated for 10, 15, 20 years of the education process, just to begin with, to think, and then for dessert, think some more. And so that and thought is praised as a being of ultimate value and significance. So there is a heavy current of conditioning there, but still, that notwithstanding, even though that tendency is very powerful to believe in thought and to buy into it, in actuality, it is just another sense object. And we do have the capacity to be able to perceive it with clarity, with mindfulness, without confusion. So it's very easy to, if we don't see this, to set up a kind of dichotomy between, on the one hand, the mind which is thinking, and on the other hand, the mind which is not thinking. So we steer the meditation towards being like praising clear, open space. The mind is concentrated, bright, not thinking. Good. This is good. This is what I want at last. And I do admit, when I first came into the monastery, the concept that the mind could ever stop thinking was just a kind of bad joke, because it was a like I felt very much like a friend of ours who was doing a PhD in philosophy at Cambridge University. And after a 10-day retreat, I asked him, so how's your meditation going, James? He says, oh, it's great. I only think three things at once instead of six. So we got a 100% improvement there. And I felt rather like that. And I remember it was about, I'd been in the monastery a couple of years, every week we have an all-night meditation vigil, and I think I'd been up all night and I hadn't rested during the whole day, and then we had a sauna at the monastery that we'd use for, it's quite customary from the time of the Buddha for monasteries to have a sauna, like what they call a firehouse, Chantagara, as a health and well-being of the community. And so we'd have a sauna the night after the all-night sitting. So we'd been up all night, up all day, and then in the sauna for a couple of hours, and everyone had left. So, all of my energetic systems were completely exhausted. And so sitting in the sauna, everyone had gone, and I was sitting there. And finally, my mind stopped thinking. Everything went very, very quiet, and I thought, it stopped. Wow. And in that moment, I realized my entire conscious lifetime, that the thinking had never actually stopped till that moment. So that was very delicious, like, wow. It can, not only can stop, but it did stop. Amazing, incredible, wonderful. And so it is pleasant, when it's been going like, a kind of freight train for 20 years. But to exalt that and to praise that as something beneficial and perfect and pure in itself is a mistake. And so that it's like seeking the emptiness of absence, the kind of non-presence of thought. It's rather like, if only I didn't have to feel or sense or perceive anything, then I would be fine. And so even though there can be a quality of relief, that the absence of stimulation, the absence of perception in itself, the absence of thinking in itself is not purity, it's not peace. Those of you who have done a lot of concentration practice or put serious effort or found the mind coming to a place of not thinking, you might, after the initial sense of relief or pleasantness, after a certain period of time, there arises a thought, is this it? This is pretty boring. It's like watching a TV with no program. We might sit there criticizing the American TV and its program, but it's a heck of a lot more interesting than watching a blank screen. That's into one of these sort of minimalist Andy Warhol type shows. We can set up a kind of dichotomy between, on the one hand, the mind in the thinking state, and on the other hand, the mind, even if it's not sort of bland, but just praising that quality of, even if the mind is very, very bright and joyful, saying, well, that's a good meditation, and then if the mind is sinking, then that's not really meditation at all. So if you find yourself judging things in that way, then we need to back off and to sort of reconsider, to look at it differently. So when we talk about investigation, it's helpful to understand that this is, it's not even like a sort of a little bit of a compromise with the peaceful mind. It's not like, oh, well, I can keep a peaceful mind and have a little bit of intrusion as well, which is how you might think of it. The thinking is still really a kind of an intrusion. I can tolerate it, or I can cope with a little bit, but it actually really would be nice if it wasn't there at all. Even if we hold it in that way, then it's still a mistake. And it's not that I'm praising the chattering mind, even though my mouth can chatter extensively, but it's just really understanding how it all fits together. But if you are acquainted with the one of the Buddha's multitude of lists called the seven factors of enlightenment, the Bojjhanga, the Sutta Bojjhanga, the first of those is mindfulness. And the second is investigation of Dhamma, Dhamma Vichaya. Then the third is Virya, energy. Then the fourth is Piti, which is joy or rapture. Then the next one is Pasadi, which is tranquility. And then the sixth one is Samadhi, concentration, focus, mental collectedness. And then the last one is equanimity, Upekha. So there's different ways that these are represented in the teachings, and different ways that they're talked about. And sometimes they're listed as, you know, that sati, mindfulness, leads to investigation of Dhamma arouses energy, energy leads to joy, joy leads to tranquility, tranquility leads to concentration, etc. So they're kind of a sequence of A goes to B, goes to C, goes to D, and so on. But in other situations, they're described as being coexistent. Like that when the mind is enlightened, when the mind is completely free of obstruction, of greed, hatred, and delusion, when there is awakenedness, then all these seven qualities are there. So that the seven natural attributes of the pure heart, the pure mind. Just as, like with water, you can say that it has fluidity, it has temperature, it has a taste, it has color, it has movement. You know, you could come up with seven different qualities that a glass of water has, and they all coexist together. That they are all factors, but they're all coexisting at the same time. So that these don't exclude each other. So just because the fact that the mind is tranquil doesn't mean to say that it's not energetic. And just because there is equanimity and concentration doesn't mean to say that there is the Dhamma Vijaya, the investigation, sort of switches off. There's like all of those qualities can coexist. So Dhamma Vichaya, investigation of Dhamma, it's like referring to the natural intelligence, the quality of mind which recognizes pattern, which discerns order and the kind of relatedness of things. It's kind of looking into and seeing what's going on here. What is what's a pattern? What is the nature of this is being experienced. So it's an innate investigative function that the mind possesses. And when it's completely free, when the mind is completely awake and liberated, that quality of investigation, considering, is still going on. And there's also other ways, other terms used to describe it. Yoniso manasikara is another very closely related term, which means literally means the going to the root of things, paying attention to the origin of the source, the root of things. It's sometimes translated as wise consideration or wise reflection. So the way to apply this. So it's, in a way, it's helpful to think of not of investigation as a thing I am doing, but just seeing it as a natural attribute of the mind. When I am not doing anything, when you just just imagine the mind is completely awake and free, it is investigating on its own. It's not like so. Therefore, you can't really see that quality of exploration as an intrusion or as a corruption. It's just, it's a natural attribute, aptitude of the mind to do that. But that's a function of awareness. It looks for order, it explores, it investigates, it is, say, discerning the relatedness of the different elements that are there in the experiential field. So when we, say, apply investigation, or we pick that up, it's really just empowering a faculty of mind that already exists. So in this way, that it's not, we don't have to think of it as a special thing that I'm doing, but just say taking a single faculty that we have, like awareness or like loving kindness, and by attending to it, by picking it up, by steering it, we clarify and assist that quality in operating. So a way to use investigation, there's two basic pathways. One is just as things come up on their own, so under their own steam, or picking up a particular theme that you want to look at. Say there's something in your life that you know you don't understand, or that is kind of mystifying to you, or it's a big issue in your life. Actually, meditation is the very best time to do our thinking, rather than looking at, oh, now's the time to meditate, switch it off. You know, if you need to think about something, that is actually the best time to do it, is to when you meditate. So the way I work with it, just to give you an example, I mean, different people function differently. But first of all, to sit down and to focus the mind and center the attention as fully and completely as possible, relaxing the body and the mind, just letting the mind be as still as possible. And so if there's something that you want to investigate, say, fear of death, or why when certain situation happens we find ourselves very aggressive, or why is it that you we feel that we have a particular obsession, that we have a kind of compulsive desire for this, or a fear of that, or there's a tangled relationship in your life, you know, with your spouse or your parent or your child or your someone at work, you're in a difficult situation at your work life, whatever it might be. It can be anything problematic, or it can be just some kind of subject of the teachings, like, say, dependent origination. Say, I really can't figure out, what is this dependent origination? How can it be? You know, how does it work that ignorance conditions, mental formations, volitional formations, what does that mean? So any of those different ranges, you can use it for all kinds of things of that nature. So you'd sit down and then deliberately bring that in to awareness. Say, okay, so what is, when I use the word ignorance, what is that? What is ignorance? And as I was describing the other day, you're really just you're not trying to enter into a sort of logical process, but really just like consulting your own wisdom, drawing on your own wisdom. So like you're arousing that question or that subject, and just seeing what arises, you know, in response to that. And then that the whole tone of investigation is a very measured and spacious quality. So you bring up a subject and say, okay, what is that about? Bring it to mind, and then what I find is then you'll get a small kind of train of thought will arise, so some images or some ideas will appear in response to that, and then because of the level of concentration and steadiness, then that train of thought comes to an end. There's a space, and you say, okay, well, if that's the case, or If it's about that, then what does it say about such and such? And then something arises in response to that. You say, oh, that's interesting. I never thought of it that way. Uh-huh. And then pursuing it in that fashion. So just seeing if there's whatever arises in accordance with that. And just having this sort of rhythmic, measured quality. So there's thinking going on, but it's thought that's happening within a spacious medium. And if you find that as soon as you drop something in or you raise a subject, then immediately the mind sort of races off and starts chattering, then you know, okay, come back, you know, relax. It's too charged. Just, you know, and then you need to know you've got to have a much more of a firm attention on the tranquility and the pasadi and the samadhi, the tranquility and the concentration, that you're going to have to tilt in that direction. But if that's well established, then the investigation, you can just let it kind of flow on and on and on, picking up a subject. So sometimes if I have to sort of take part in a conference, or someone's asked me to do a Dhamma talk with a particular theme, or I have a workshop to do on a particular subject, I'll sit myself down with like a legal pad and a pen and sit in my kuti and just... and then I'll write down the title of the workshop or the talk or whatever at the top of the page, and then just close read it and close my eyes and then say it to myself. And so it might be something like, say, the Dharma and nature, or might be the Buddhist attitude towards death and dying. And then just seeing what associations get made, things, different thoughts will come up, and I'll just write them down. And then just using that that situation of the mind in its clearest possible state to draw upon the knowledge, intelligence, you know, associated thinking. And more often than not, you find associations or ideas or images, patterns emerge that you know that you wouldn't normally think of, or that don't normally kind of form, and so that you're thinking actually in the clearest way, but it's not just like a logical. You're not sort of driving the thought towards some kind of logical conclusion. You're not looking for an answer, but it's like opening up a kind of casket of jewels just to see what's in there. Or maybe it's a casket of rubbish. So, and also the whole quality of it, because it's not a goal-oriented, it's not an end-oriented process. So sometimes when one does this, using investigation, it's like, well, what should I do about my sister? And then there's this very, very profound silence. And then you realize there's nothing to do. And whereas, you know, that in a normal state, you might be sort of, what about this? What about that? And the mind kind of goes off creating options and gets caught into kind of questioning and doubting. In that sort of, using Dhamma Vijaya or investigation, then it's like in some situations it might be, there's nothing you can do. But then you know that there's nothing you can do. Or that something is not knowable, like Tarani was saying last night. So particularly with dependent origination, there are some aspects of it, you know, for literally I had that on, well, maybe one day I'll kind of understand that piece, for like 8 or 10 years. Seriously. It's like every so often I pick it up and think, well, how does that work? Or what does that mean? And it's just like not knowable. Right now that the pieces are not there whereby that is knowable. And you know, you kind of poke and you look at it this way and look at it that way, and it's just like no. No reading. Okay. File not found, you know. Okay. And literally, you know, 8 or 10 years just having one particular sort of theme on hold. And but you know, and then realizing, okay, well, right now that is not knowable. This is in, if you want a Pali word for this quality, it's called ananya tanyasa mitindriya, the faculty of knowing the unknown. You know that you don't know. And that's actually extremely liberating, because it's like there's 99.999% of all things that are knowable in the universe, we don't know. So it's just that the vast majority can just, you know, dump it in that pile, the ananya tanyasa mitindriya heap. So, you know, I know that I don't know. Okay, fine. Yeah, plant it there. Let's go back to my 0.0001%, you know, what I call my life and what all the things I know about. But I kind of like to play around in, because it makes me feel secure. But. So, that there's a... but having investigated, having used that Dhamma Vijaya, it's like, we realize that we're not incomplete because we haven't figured that out. And so that this is like using investigation as a sort of particular meditational method. And even though the thinking is going on, it's actually very, very peaceful. And the thought is held just as like, if one is mindful of the visual field, like right now, if I'm not sort of... absorbed or irritated or excited about what I'm seeing, it's just here is seeing. The seeing doesn't interrupt the peace of the mind, hearing, feeling. It's just another sense, pattern of sense object. That's all. It's not an intrusion. It's not an invasion. There's no place for it to land. It's just this. So the thinking is happening within that context of pure awareness, pure presence. So then the other methodology is just applying that reflective process as things just arise on their own, just things that pop in. Then it's just, say, holding them, training the mind to pick them up, to notice them, and to hold them in that same way, to process them in that same reflective way. And Ajahn Chah used this a lot. If when you listen to his accounts of talking about working with his own mind and his own practice, he had like this whole kind of inner analysis going on the whole time. Well, not the whole time, but a lot of the time. And he would talk about how, you know, such and such a thing arose, and he thought about it like this, and then he'd have these dialogues going on internally. And very actively using thought to explore. Like when a mood would come up, so he'd say, well, what's that about? Or how am I thinking that? Or if I'm thinking that, then what does that mean about this? And really picking up and working with all of the different, like tracking the different moods and feelings that would flow during the course of a day. So it doesn't mean that to use investigation, we have to be sort of sitting down in a quiet place with our eyes closed. But it's something that we can very actively be employing throughout the course of a day. So, you come into the hall and somebody's moved your cushion. So then we see, like, look at that. You know, I come in and then, you know, you see that your cushion's been moved like at least 4 inches. I mean, 4 whole inches, or even a foot. Someone's moved your cushion, and then you feel this sort of outrage arises. And so then, you know, to reflect on that, it's like, oh, isn't that interesting? So here I am, and I say, this is my patch. And so suddenly, you know, this is, I'm defending my territory. My territory's been invaded. And why would that emotion be so strong? I mean, a week ago, this wasn't mine. You know, before the retreat began, it wasn't anybody's. This was IMS. You know, it's not mine. And now, isn't that interesting? Then I find this spot and I call this mine. And then it becomes very precious. And then someone comes along and invades it. And they've invaded my space. How dare they? I want to kill them. Because they've invaded my space. And so here I am contemplating homicide, at least for a moment, over someone moving my cushion. Isn't that interesting? And what made it my space in the first place? So you're actually using this kind of verbal thought to pick up that wave of feeling and follow it. Say, well, if I did actually murder this person for moving my cushion, what would that sound like talking to the police officer? Or Cindy, she's the most understanding retreat manager. And, you know, if I go to her office and say, and Cindy, I have to let you know I just murdered one of the other retreatants. So. Well, you know, she did move my cushion, so there's mitigating circumstances, but, I just want, as retreat manager, I thought you ought to know this, and I just wonder what the next appropriate thing to do about this situation is. The body's lying there in the hall, and I think we ought to do something about, getting some help carrying it out. You know? You know, you can have a lot of fun with this kind of thing. Or that, if you find, like we've been talking a lot about self-criticism. So one of the ways that you can use investigation is to say, look at that self-critical urge and say, like when we look at our, you know, we feel ourselves kind of twitching and shifting and changing our posture and say, well, that guy next to me, he hasn't moved in the entire week. He's absolutely riveted in his samadhi, and me, I'm sort of shuffling and shifting like a kind of an ant on a hot plate, you know. And I'm such a useless meditator, and he looks so noble, and you know, her on that side, you know, she's amazing. She never even blinks, you know. Just like totally composed and restrained, and I'm just this agitated, you know, vibrating intrusion on the universe. In fact, and then you see the kind of wave of feeling, like judging yourself against your neighbors, and then you see that process happening, like, God, I'm such a twitchy, helpless, useless thing. And then you feel that, you know, you recognize that feeling and say, then investigation would be, you could pick it up and say, taking it to absurdity. Like, I am probably the most agitated human being on the planet. Yes, I think I am probably the most agitated human being on the planet. It's impossible for there to be anyone who's more fidgety and agitated than I am. And these people sitting next to me, not only are they utterly still and serene, they're probably in at least fourth jhana, if not seventh or eighth. And in fact, everybody in this hall is probably an extraordinarily skilled meditator. They're probably not even sotapannas. They're at least, you know, once returners or non-returners. There's probably even half a dozen arahants in the place. But, you know, but me, I'm just an infection that's been sent along to see if we can try the patience of these noble and wonderful, totally holy beings. And so you pick up the mood, and you sort of extend it to its logical conclusion, and we begin to see how absurd it is. That's one way of using it. Desire objects. When you find yourself wanting something, like I was saying about stopping thinking. If only I could stop thinking, then I'd be happy. Wouldn't it be nice if just this thing could just shut up? And then you say, okay, well, if you got that result, then if you never thought another thought ever again, then would that guarantee that you would always be happy? I just like just following it through like that, and then immediately the heart says no. Or like if you find yourself being greedy for food. We had a wonderful menu presented by Taraniya last night. Popcorn and muffins and milkshakes, and Jody Parlow wrote them down, actually. Dinner with Taraniya. So you find yourself greedy for something, or that you want something that, wow, I could really use a whatever. And if I could just have that, then I'd be happy. And then you say, okay, and then just to follow it through, like, okay, so that, so to eat a such and such, one of Gloria's glorious muffins. That was her, the title of her first book. Gloria's glorious muffins. Available at bookstores near you. And so you say, if only I had one of Gloria's glorious muffins, then I would be happy. And then you say, well, if eating the muffin is happiness, then eating two muffins would be twice the happiness. And then, is the happiness in the muffin or is the happiness in me? And then you say, well, where is the happiness? And when you actually eat the muffin, where is the satisfaction? How long does it last? Where is that? Or another example that a friend of mine, a nun in the Tibetan tradition, would use is saying, well, when like a mother and child have been separated from each other, and then they meet at the train station, and then the kid comes running off the train, and mum comes running across the platform, and they hug each other. Great happiness. How wonderful. So that then, if they then stay, is the happiness of coming together, right? So that the coming together is happiness. So then they stay in their hug for a minute, 10 minutes, an hour, 12 hours, a day, a week. So what's the happiness? You know, it gets pretty boring after, you know, a very short period of time. So that we begin to use that faculty of exploring and saying, well, that we're taking the habitual reactions and judgments, the habits of the conditioned mind, and opening them up. It's like, you know, looking into the implications of what we want, what we fear, what we dislike. Just the impulsive, compulsive reactions and opinions that we have. So that just the way, you know, the way that we judge people, that we also can see through investigation how we limit the way that other people are. And when we name someone as a doctor or as a politician or as a friend, as a relation. Just by seeing that, you know, by how we create limitations on each other by the way that we name them. So if we notice that we have a compulsive judgment that, you know, all Republicans are morons. Okay, does that mean so that whenever someone says Republican, I immediately jump into my critical statement, my kind of critical habit patterns? And so it's like we realize that that's happening. So we then, you know, to pick it up. And again, you can use a sort of taking it to absurdity. Like when someone says Republican, then you feel this tension in you. And you say, does that mean that everyone in the United States of America who voted Republican is therefore a person possessed of no redeeming feature? That if all those who voted Republican left the country, this would be a better place. Or if they all keeled over dead, then I would be happy. It's ridiculous, isn't it? But yet in that impulse of when you say, oh, well, you know, she's a Republican, ugh. Or Democrat, or whatever. I mean, he voted for Nader, ugh. You know, we create these judgments and then we make them as absolute. So I say, okay, so everyone who voted for Ralph Nader is completely responsible for all of the crimes of George W. Bush. Or even just saying George W. Bush. I mean, what does that do to your mind? Yeah. Now, I'm not as monastics, we don't vote, and also I'm a Brit, so I'm one of the those from the tyranny of whom you escaped and celebrate your independence. But but one must bear in mind that George W. Bush is not entirely, not absolutely every aspect of his being is worthy of criticism. There are probably many aspects of his nature that are quite fine, noble. In fact, he is another living being. You know, when you spread metta for all the other living beings, and you share the blessings of your life with all these other living beings, you know, he's one of them. And believe it or not, that the quality of the actual fundamental nature of his mind is not different from mine or yours. the water that he drank today is the same water. It's the same nature that the water that comprises our bodies is made from. But yet you say, George, you just say W nowadays. That's enough. You know, this entire this poor letter of the alphabet has now suddenly been shunted into this sort of degraded place because of our man. So, just say, I mean, isn't it amazing? Just say W, and everyone goes, ugh! That's what conditioning does. It's like, okay, that's what, you use that to say, isn't that interesting? There's this kind of reaction that happens. So that you're using that power of thought and intelligence to tease open the reactive patterns and opinions, judgments. And so then when we open them up, then we're allowing that our innate wisdom, the kind of that which recognizes the patterns of nature and the ordering of things, it allows that to operate. And then it says, we recognize, oh, that's going way too far. It kind of reveals to us a much more clearer and complete picture. So when we are outside of a retreat time and we're having to deal with a lot more complexity of perceptions, when you're having bigger decisions to make than how many spoonfuls of cereal, and you have to look after your family or run a business or deal with traffic on the freeway, and we're having to make dozens of decisions a day, some of them very heavily loaded with people's lives and so forth depending on, and we have to deal with very sort of intense emotions and projections we have to perform as personalities, then this developing this quality of reflection, of investigation, as like an ongoing process is incredibly useful. It's like a way of sustaining mindfulness. If you think mindfulness is just kind of holding everything under control and then labeling it, or doing everything in a very deliberate fashion, we're going to suffer enormously because the world is not under control. if we feel that in order to be mindful, we have to have this kind of sterilized environment to sustain it, then we really may put ourselves into a very weakened position. We're kind of misunderstanding mindfulness. Now, just as Taraniya was saying last night, I think what she began with, like this quality of understanding mindfulness as like mindfulness, the mindful. So it's not a kind of just a sort of particular attention to a detail, but it's really that when the mind is full of the present, full of the moment, as mindfulness is really what we're aiming at. And that whether it happens to be full of a quiet retreat space, or it happens to be full of the freeway, or it happens to be full of, you know, life at the office, or negotiating the aisles at Safeways, dealing with, you know, six kinds of option paralysis, that that's what it's full of, and that the heart can be open to that. And developing this quality of investigation is one of the ways that we can keep like a track, really keep attuned to what's going on, what we're experiencing, the flow of mood and feeling, the flow of perception, what's going on inside us. That just say, you know, that you're coming out of a retreat and then you go into Safeways. And I do know people who have actually been paralyzed. Yeah, 84,000 kinds of bread, and 25 kinds of mayonnaise. And, you know, there's the but then using the investigative quality is like, okay, well, here I am. This is the experience of being hit by Safeways, and it's like this, you know, that because of, you know, of the mind being suddenly zapped by all these, you know, colors and forms and promises, then the system gets overloaded. So it feels like this, you know, that, you know, because I've come in here and taken these perceptions on, then this effect happens. You know, it's just natural. Or just tracking that feeling of being overwhelmed. Like, oh, this is the feeling of being overwhelmed. It's like this. That. And then you're picking up and processing, digesting, using the thinking faculty to work with and to notice what's going on inside us. So that even though there might be an intensity, or it might be very agitated or active, just that stepping back and noticing, oh, this is what agitation feels like. This is the kind of frenzy on the freeway. It feels like this. But, you know, if you're in a car and you're driving and it's sort of rush hour and on the freeway, then this is the feeling of it. You know, if I wasn't on the freeway, it wouldn't feel this way. I am on the freeway, so it does. And then in that moment of reflecting on it in that way, then the heart recognizes, well, of course, you know, you put yourself on the freeway, this is the result of it. It's ordinary. It's not necessarily an intrusion. Just as if you've had a busy day, a lot going on, you know, meeting a lot of people or traveling and having to process a whole bunch of different experiences, you sit down to meditate in the evening, what's going to be there? Big surprise. You know, it's the resonances of the day. It's going boom. It's like, you know, how long after the ringing of the bell does the resonance keep going? You know, if you had the whole day. Then you get home. Okay, now it's time to meditate. But of course, you know, your bell's been rung all hour after hour. So, big surprise there at the end of the day, there's some resonance. So it's like, oh, well, this is the after effect of the day. You know, you receive these kind of stimulation, and so therefore it resonates. So, a few well-placed reflections, a couple of well-placed thoughts, can save you weeks of grief. Because you can say, oh, I can't meditate, this is terrible, I've got to quit my job, I've got to go off to the forest, I'm going to get a cabin and hide out in the mountains, and because we're holding that experience as being some sort of something gone wrong with my practice, rather than, well, no, you know, if there's nothing wrong with your practice. It's just if you experience that kind of agitation and noise during the day, then there it is at the end of the day. You don't have to argue with it. You don't have to fight against it. Just by recognizing that it's a natural result of, it's the effect of certain causes, then we find peace, complete peace in the attitude towards it. And that, so peace is not, we're not looking for peace in the absence of perception or the absence of emotional mood, but peace is found in the attitude that we have towards it. And that you find that there can be an immense kind of buzz and churning and noise going on, either emotionally or physically, and yet just there have been some kind of intense meeting or some kind of family crisis and some sort of big upsurge, and then, you know, just taking that a moment to reflect and just to say, well, look at that one go. And then it's still going. Yeah, it hasn't like stopped. But in that moment, it's like, oh, this is a thing which is going. This is just a mental reaction. It's like this. Oh, that's all. Like, oh, well, of course, you know, if it's just something like this is set in motion, this is the effect of it. It feels like this. No big deal. And we find that it might still be there, but the heart is at peace with it. And that's freedom. That's where the heart is liberated, not in you know, getting rid of or wiping out all the abrasive experiences. I mean, obviously, there's a certain attraction towards, you know, silence and quietude and beautiful and unaggressive experiences, and when the option is there, we can gravitate towards those or cultivate those. I mean, we don't hold retreats, you know, in the middle of the freeway, you know, because it's not a place that is kind of maximizes the conditions for peace and you know, calm of mind and reflection. So if we want to hold a retreat, we find a quiet place like IMS to do it. But if we make ourselves dependent on this, like, this is the only way I can be peaceful is go do a 10-day at IMS, and the rest is just, you know, being a wage slave to save up enough money to do the next retreat, and you sort of grit your teeth and tolerate the in-between, then we've wasted the opportunity. We haven't really learned anything useful. We've turned the quietude of a retreat into a very dependent refuge. You know, and it's certainly better to have that kind of refuge than none at all. But if we set that up in our minds, then we're really not making full use of what the Buddha Dharma can provide, can lead us to. The point of a retreat, the usefulness of a retreat is like a five finger exercises for, you know, playing a musical instrument. You know, it's like you do the exercises, you do the scales, and you learn the tunes, and you play them over and over and over and over and over. So when it comes time to sort of to improvise and to sort of get out there and play, your fingers know where to go. You don't have to think about it. It's not like, oh, I can only, you know, the whole point of doing the exercises is to do, you know, to learn how to perfect scales. You might become very, 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 very good at scales, but the point of the scales is to be able to produce music. And so that's how I see, you know, retreat time is very essential and very blessed and beautiful, but the point is to enable to learn skills that then can help us along in the flow of the experience of living, you know, the rest of our life, so that we relate to these times as something, you know, very, you know, pleasant and helpful and supportive, but it's not like the retreat is the real thing. Don't try not to set that up in your mind, and that the rest is a sort of a grim necessity that we tolerate. It's really not going to help you at all to hold it in that way. There are many other skillful means that we can use, we can employ, and probably in the next day or two, Tan Punadamo and Tarani and myself will talk some more about some of those qualities to help sustain that meshing of the practice with, you know, more complex patterns of experience that we call kind of outside retreat, or that weird concept of real life. But there are many, many ways that we can accurately and effectively and validly mesh this kind of practice with a much greater complexity of experience, having to do things, go places, be someone, say, talk, act, engage, relate, having to be, you know, involved in all that way, that you know, if we are really understanding and developing mindfulness and learning to act wisely, then, you know, we find that whether a situation is very controlled and peaceful like this, or whether it's very noisy and active and demanding, that there's still an extraordinary simplicity. We still know that we don't have to have a whole sort of game plan, a whole script written out for you know, every action that we're going to perform, or a whole repertoire of agendas of what we, you know, how we're going to do this and what we want to do about that, and when I meet with this, I'm going to be like this. When I meet with that, I'm going to be like that. That, you know, strategies for trying to deal with the world without getting disturbed by it. We don't need that. All we need is the one rule of be mindful. Yeah, and trust that, you know, that whatever we meet with, whether it's calm and quiet and still, or whether it's turbulent, whether it's exciting, whether it demands our responsibility or whatever, that if we trained ourselves to trust our own heart, to be mindful, that if we really draw upon that in any situation, we'll know what to do. We'll be able to respond to that situation. If we need to no matter whether it's inside a retreat, outside a retreat, or whatever, whether we have to be, you know, in charge, or we have to be submissive, or whether we have to take responsibility, or get out of the way, or whatever, the heart knows this is the time to do this. This is the way to respond to that. So that the usefulness of this kind of practice is like discovering that quality, learning how to apply it, and trusting it. Just that a responsiveness to each situation, moment by moment. That's the main thing to be learning. And then we use the props like keeping the precepts, investigation. Mindfulness of the body, all these kind of explicit sort of practices, they're really just there to support that basic process of attending, you know, opening the heart to the present moment, being fully with that, and letting ourselves respond from that place of naturalness and simplicity and unbiasedness. So I will finish there after these thoughts this evening.